Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome back, friends. This is episode 293 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I want to say a huge thank you to the patrons who make this show possible, as well as to Paragon City Games, which you can check out at ParagonCityGames.com. While this weekend there are no premier Magic events, we do have Grand Prix Chiba and Grand Prix Sacramento in our sights for next weekend, so that should be pretty fun. And I do want to mention that last weekend was the pre-release for Magic Core 2019. Did you go? How was it? I had Navy duty that weekend. Boo. So I was not able to go and play. I've only missed three pre-releases since I came back into Magic, that being the third one. So it's a bummer. I love going. I usually go to a midnight one just so I can, you know, get the cards as soon as possible and play and have a good time and meet up with some friends. But I wasn't able to go this time. So how is it? Do you like the set? I would love to hear all about it. Come to the Facebook group, mtgpro2.com/Facebook group. And you can tell us all about your pre-release and tell us what you got, what you liked, is it slow, all that good stuff. Also, in case you didn't know, in the Facebook group, it's a great place to connect with past guests of the show. There are several past guests who are in there that you can tag in your posts and ask questions, and they're pretty good about answering them, and it's a really cool way to connect with people who you hear on the show and maybe want to learn more from. So it's really cool. And of course, there are the other prodigies hanging out in there that you can learn from and grow from and ask questions to. And it's just a really cool community. I love what we fostered there. I love how it's a place that you can ask any question and not get flame sprayed, no matter how, you know, newbie or simple it might be. And it's just a really good place to be. I love our group. And that's due to you, the prodigies. Thank you so much for being respectful, for upholding our values of dedication, sportsmanship, and respect, and really extending that to everybody around you. Thank you so much. Well, as we continue marching through the summer here, we have a great guest lined up, so let's bring him in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I'm super pumped to have our guest with us today. Our guest is an engineering PhD student from Glasgow, Scotland. He is building his Magic resume with finishes such as winning the PTQ at GP Liverpool and making it into the top 16 at Pro Tour Dominaria. Coming to us from Glasgow, Scotland, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Danny Anderson. Danny, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Sean. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, we are so excited to have you. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take the game to the next level?
Yeah, let's see what we've got kicking around in there. So
excellent. Sweet. Now, prodigies, if you want to connect with Danny, you can find him on Twitter at Danderson92. So pretty straightforward there, at Danderson92. So hit him up, say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question, but you can connect with him there. So Danny, we mentioned right there in the bio that you are an engineering PhD student. So that's pretty cool. So you're doing the whole student thing and playing Magic at the same time, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I've been basically a full-time student now for the last 8 years, going through my undergrad in electrical engineering, and sort of carried that on through into now my third year of a PhD. So everything that we're doing just now is kind of balancing between schoolwork, everything else, and then also Magic, traveling to events, and traveling to pro tours and stuff. So
electrical engineering is your cup of tea?
Yeah, that's right. Electrical engineering, specializing in communications.
So. Okay. I was going to say, do you have plans with that, like designing or working or teaching, or like what got you into engineering and where do you want to take it?
I think my goals just now are, I have a thesis that's due in sort of the end of October. So that's where most of my energy is going just now. But I believe I'll be able to stay on in a research position at the university I'm at just now for at least another year, which will continue to fund this lifestyle that I've become accustomed to of world traveling and card slinging. So
love it, man. That's so cool that, you know, especially in today's day and age, we're able to, you know, craft the life that we want and find ways to make it happen, you know. So that's really cool that you're able to study something that you enjoy, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't have stuck around for PhD in it, and be able to leverage that into something else that you enjoy, which is traveling the world and being able to play cards. That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm really fortunate to have wound up in this position where I've got a job that I enjoy, but also has a very flexible hour base.
Yeah, for sure. That's so cool. So where did your competitive bug come from? Obviously playing, you know, Magic at high levels, there has to be something in there. So were you a gamer growing up, play sports? Like, tell us a little bit about that.
So I actually started playing card games when I was sort of around 13, 14. And I started off playing the Yu-Gi-Oh! Trading card game, whereas I think like most people seem to, it does seem to sort of be the gateway into that or like Pokemon. Mm-hmm. And so from that age, I was traveling around Scotland, which does not sound impressive. Scotland's quite small. It's very easy to travel around. you can get from one side of the country within an hour. So I was used to traveling sort of locally, going to all the game shops and everything, sort of getting well known in the Scottish gaming scene from quite an early age. When I was 16, 17, there was a group that picked up the WoW trading card game.
Yes.
And that was probably the first game that I played to a high competitive level. There was a group that were an exceptional group that traveled out of Glasgow, won European championships, placed in world championships, won the UK national tournaments on a regular basis. So I was quite fortunate to be a very small part of that group, sort of very much the youngest, kind of learning the ropes from all of these guys. So when that game, unfortunately, sort of died, 2011, 2012, mechanically it was sort of very similar to Magic in terms of, you know, a resource-based system, combat, steps, creatures, spells, all this kind of thing. So It was a reasonable sort of sidestep transition into playing Magic. I think my first event might have been an M13 draft, but I didn't really pick up until Return to Ravnica block, which was, I think I played the Gatecrash pre-release, which would have been February 2013. I think if my dates are right, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, yes.
So that was kind of it. I was fortunate enough to live sort of walking distance from one of the biggest shops in Scotland at the time. It is unfortunately closed. That was Spellbound Games. So I got to walk to that shop, you know, every Friday, every Wednesday, you know, and play with some of the best players in the country. So,
man, that's really cool. So just your background with, you know, games in general and leading to Magic, what got you into Yu-Gi-Oh in the very first place? Just, you know, all your mates at school were playing, or like what was the draw there? Cause that obviously got you into card games.
I have asked myself that question before, and I actually can't remember.
How did this all start? I have no idea.
I have a sneaking suspicion that at one point I was away on a family weekend or something to, you know, some beach town, and me and my dad, we were walking around, and I think I just saw, literally what saw in the window, this starter deck that looked kind of cool. I had some, you know, I'm 12 years old or whatever, I've got some pocket money, and I bought it because it looked quite cool. And
yeah,
I started like playing that. You used to get like the little games for like the Game Boy and stuff, and I would play those. And eventually my granddad found out that there was a small playgroup, a playing group rather than like a local game store that met at a community center near us. So I started going to that.
Wow.
And it kind of, everything went from there. So
that's really cool. And then how did you first learn or hear about Magic? So obviously you're playing WoW, and then like you said, a logical sidestep into Magic. Again, with like all your competitive mates like, oh, hey, like, let's play this game. Or how did you even know about Magic to move into it?
So a lot of the guys, when they picked up the WoW TCG, had Magic experience. And a lot of the people that did really well at the very start of like the WoW TCG were accomplished in the world of Magic. Like the first world champion for the WoW TCG was Guillaume Matignon.
Yeah.
So, you know, that guy knows how to play Magic. So a lot of the early sort of adopters of like the WoW TCG had Magic experience. And that was the same in our our playgroup that was based out of this shop, Spellbound Games.
Got it.
So when we would be in drafting, you know, the WoW TCG on a Wednesday, there would be a group in doing whatever Magic set was out at the time. You know, they would be drafting and they would be practicing for whatever PTQ was coming up or whatever GP they were going to travel to. So.
Right. Well, cool. So then, like I said, just a logical sidestep and in you went. And you consider Gatecrash to be your first set?
That's the first set that was definitely like my first pre-release. I was like already mechanically familiar. And yeah, I think so. Gatecrash, the Gatecrash pre-release.
Cool. And what's been your favorite set?
I really enjoyed, I think Battle for Zendikar is probably one of my favorites, which is kind of a strange one for people to pick. But I think that was kind of when I started, traveling to like to GPs and stuff and really playing the constructed formats. Like I had built up enough of a collection to start doing that.
Yeah.
So I think I've got some rose tinted glasses for the Battle for Zendikar.
Nice. I like it. And what's one of your favorite cards?
I have definitely cast more than my fair share of Unlicensed Disintegration.
Oh, nice.
So I would probably put that somewhere near the top.
For those of us who don't know, what is it? What does it do? And why do you like Unlicensed Disintegration?
So Unlicensed Disintegration is an instant for one black and a red. Destroy target creature. If you control an artifact, deal 3 damage to the creature's controller. So the first time I cast it, you could also redirect it to the damage to planeswalkers. So quite often you were killing their blocker and usually their planeswalker or just them. And when this came out as part of Kaladesh block, you had the really powerful 2 mana artifacts like Smuggler's Copter and Scrap Heap Scrounger, and also things like Toolcraft Exemplar and Thraven Inspector. So you had a really aggressive artifact base, and it made for one of the most efficient removal spells I think that we've seen in Standard in quite a long time. So
yeah, it's a beast, definitely powerhouse. So I guess you don't use that card too much anymore now, unless or do you? Do you play any formats that you still get to cast it?
Still Standard legal, so.
Yeah, I guess for now. Yeah, that's true.
It's I would probably say that, you know, somewhere around 80% of the tournaments I think I've ever won have probably registered that card to some degree or another.
Love it.
So
good stuff. Yeah, that is a good card. Well, sweet. So we got a little bit of your firsts and your favorites, and I'd love to kind of talk about when you started taking Magic. Well, so it sounds like you kind of went right into competitive Magic, right? Like, because you're already a competitive card player and you went right into competitive Magic when you came over?
Yeah, I was already used to the grind, so to speak. So traveling to the WTCG equivalent of GPs, they were called Dark Moon Fairs. So I was already quite familiar with the travel schedule and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So then when it came to Magic, because then you had to kind of apply your skills to Magic and whatnot, what was an early struggle that you faced as far as Magic, competitive Magic goes, and how did you overcome that?
One of the big differences between the WTCG and Magic is in the WTCG, you effectively couldn't get mana screwed in the same way. You could always develop any card in your hand as a resource. So I found that was probably warping my mulligan decisions. So in Magic now you can sort of look at a hand with, say, 3 lands and 4 spells, and you go, oh, this hand is probably fine. Or you look at a hand with 7 spells, and you go, oh, all these spells are good if only I could cast them. If you do that in the WTCG, that is good enough. You know, 7 spells we can maybe get there. So I was probably keeping some hands early on that were maybe a bit too color intensive, a bit too mana hungry, a bit too greedy on my keeps. So
how have you gotten better at that? What can you share with us who are struggling with our mulligan decisions?
It does sound kind of pure trial and error. Mm-hmm. No, but the important thing is to actually look at what your hand actually accomplishes and what it's actually doing. As much as I was sort of saying, three lands, four spells, but if the spells that you have, you either can't cast or don't actually do anything in the matchup, lightning bolts against blue white control decks and things like that, then you can mulligan hands. And I think a lot of people get quite mulligan averse and sort of associate mulliganing with losing when you don't have to mulligan, you get to mulligan. There's a difference there. So,
and it's such a hard decision. You're talking about this, and I'm thinking of some of my most recent games. I played in a little league with some of the prodigies, and it was a Dominaria Seal League. I remember in one of my matches, I was thinking like for a while on this mulligan decision, because like you said, it's like, okay, so I have like one of my more expensive spells, which is only a 5-drop, but then I have the splash colored for it. So I was like, okay, so, but if I mulligan, I go down to 6 and this card is basically dead anyway. And so I was trying to figure out if I should mulligan or not. And it's just such an interesting thing, because every mulligan decision is so unique and different, and it's so hard to come up with, you can't come up with hard and fast rules, but kind of just learning, like you said, trial and error and rules of thumb and just, your deck and the matchup that you're in and stuff like that. It's such a intricate process.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that the game is so replayable, and that, even though we've played the mirror match, 20 times, there are still decisions that have to get made. So,
yeah, love it. Good stuff. So as you got more and more into, Magic and started building your history and your journey and going through events and experiencing ups and downs and learning and growing, what would you say has been your worst Magic moment?
My worst Magic moment. I have definitely had some very lackluster GP results that I found very frustrating. I think, not to sort of move the timeline too far ahead, actually probably one of the most frustrating points I ever came across was actually after Pro Tour Rivals of Ixalan.
Yeah.
So that was my first Pro Tour, and I did not do well by really any metric. There's not, we 0-5'd on the day, which is obviously not a great place, but
yeah,
it was also, it was my first one, so that's not great. And I remember sitting, having sort of left the venue, feeling quite frustrated, feeling a bit kind of sick of it, kind of just wanting to leave. And obviously people are messaging you, how are you getting on? And you just have to I'm out. And that was probably, that I can remember, like one of the most sort of frustrating kind of upsetting points.
Because we're all excited, you made the Pro Tour your first time, and maybe you realize, I might not like do the best in the world, but you definitely don't expect to go 0-5, and and that's that. So I can definitely see how that would be, really frustrating. Looking back on it, how did you move through it? What helped you through, and what can you share with us?
So at that point, I was quite fortunate to, I already knew I had a qualification sitting for Pro Tour Dominaria. So it did kind of help to have this goal to hold up and to something else to shoot for, this one didn't go well. Why didn't it go well? Let's not focus on the result. Let's focus on what we can take away from this. And, how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again? Right. Mostly. So
that was good. That was good that you had something else to look forward to. And obviously it paid off. I mean, not that it paid off. Obviously that having that there really helped, because here, your most recent, at Proto Dominaria, you ended up doing really well.
Yeah, obviously the thing that you're looking forward, you know, and you're holding up doesn't have to necessarily be a, you know, it doesn't have to be a pro tour. It could be, you know, nationals is coming up, something like that, or just a GP or a store championship or, you know, anything like that. Something to just to keep the motivation up.
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good point. It reminds me of having that longer perspective, you know, realizing that the event you're in right now, whatever it happens to be, Prodigies, whether it's a store event or a Grand Prix or whatever, it's not your last Magic event, right? There's always going to be another one. The game's, you know, here to stay. It's going to be around for a long time. And so there's always going to be an event for you to go to. And so knowing, hey, even though this event right now, I might not have done my best or as well as I wanted to, there's always another one. And having that longer perspective, I've found it helps me kind of, you know, smooth out the peaks and valleys and things like that. Because when I was like, oh my gosh, like this is the Grand Prix that I'm at and I have to do really well at this one and it's my one shot, then, you know, all the losses were really hard. But then I realized, of course, it's not my one shot. You know, there are other opportunities, and having that longer perspective, I think really, really helps. So remembering that and looking towards your next event after you've might not have done the best at any given event is, I think, a really good way to cope.
I think you could also just even extend that to a round by round basis.
Oh, yeah.
Won't help you in the short term or the long term to get frustrated about a tournament in the middle of that tournament. I think, you know, anybody that says they haven't made a mistake in the first round of a Magic tournament has never played a Magic tournament. So.
I like that. Never thought about bringing that into the event itself and just realizing, hey, there's another match. Like this isn't the only match I'm going to play. That's cool. I really like that. So obviously the flip side of our lows are our highs. What has been your proudest Magic moment, Danny?
Definitely the Pro Tour Dominaria, by far. That has been, you know, one of the best things I've accomplished in any card game. But aside from that, it would also probably be winning the PTQ to qualify for that. Sure. Mostly because of the reaction and the support that you get from your friends, from the Scottish community. That was really good. That was really special. The other thing that I would mention is actually one of the best card game moments that I've ever, you know, it's not actually about me, but I could say I was involved with watching Gary Campbell win the Legacy GP at GP Birmingham. Just at the tail end of May there.
Yeah.
That was a really fantastic moment, and I was just so happy I got to be there and watch it. I would definitely recommend finding the Twitch VOD, the archive, everything for that. The reaction from that is brilliant. So
cool. Yeah, that's really, really cool. So, like you mentioned, the Pro Tour Dominaria making top 16, like that, you know, that's a big deal, especially as you get up in the higher levels of, you know, Magic. They measure, you know, top 8s of Grand Prix, but usually top 16s of Pro Tours just because it's, you know, so competitive, so hard and whatnot. More than just making it, I'm sure getting there was, you know, a process and fun. So tell us about that experience. Like, were some highlights, and were you on fire all day, or was it a struggle? Like, what was your Pro Tour experience?
So going into it, I had a grand total of 3 Pro Points, all coming from Pro Tour rivals. And my goal at the other end was to try and hit bronze, effectively get some of my weekends free from PPTQs so I can stay playing my RPTQs. And so that was the goal. Obviously on a slightly shorter goal was, given how badly my first one had gone, hey, it'd be really good to make day 2 this time. That would be quite good. So those were like the two goals, the sort of the goal and then the stretch goal of let's get some pro points out of this. Coming out of day 1, I finished day 1 with a 5-3 record. So I've already won 5 more matches at this Pro Tour than I have in my last one. So that's already great.
That's great.
And we've qualified for day 2. So that's another big checkbox. And sort of importantly, I felt like I had played reasonably well. I was quite happy. I don't remember making any sort of significant mistakes. So I was happy that I'd sort of earned my five. And my three losses on the day came from Thorolf Servin, who is Toffel, better known as, Owen Tortenwald, and Thiago Saporito. So three very high quality opponents.
World-class players,
That felt quite good to sort of get through a field like that. So then when we go into day two, obviously the stretch goal was, hey, let's try and get ideally 7 pro points from this weekend. So I think that would be 33 points, I think. Got 7 pro points, so it's okay. A decent run today. Came out of my draft at 2-1. Still very much live for our stretch goal, and then proceeded to not lose another round in constructed, and which is still an amazing thing for me to be sitting here saying.
So. Yeah, that's so. So your final record was what?
12-4.
12-4. Nice.
5-3 on day one, and 7-1 on day two. So.
Wow, that's incredible! Congrats. And so I'm assuming you got your 7 pro points.
Yeah, that's we definitely overshot that point. That puts us to 18 points for this season.
Dang.
So I am not 100% certain how the pro club cycle works now, but I believe that if I attend either Pro Tour 25 or the Pro Tour in Atlanta in November, I should achieve silver, which should also then allow me to do the first one of 2019 as well. So I went in sort of looking just to not have to play any more PPTQs, to potentially having locked up 2 PTs, and also significantly jumped the queue for the WMC captaincy as well, which is bizarre.
That's so cool, man. This is really cool. Like have 18 points now, and like you said, even just showing up to a pro tour gets you the 3, so that's 21, so that's silver, so that's really good. And then I forgot about the WMCQ, so that's really cool getting that. That's gonna be really neat. So you're off to you're just having a great year, you know. I bet you're tickled pink.
Yeah, well, having a fantastic month, so like everything all at once. So
what other events do you have lined up? Is it just a Pro Tour, or do you have some other Grand Prix you're going to go to?
So I played GP Las Vegas 2 weeks ago now, or at the sort of middle of June.
Yeah.
And I was considering GP Barcelona, which is the weekend of the 28th. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to sort of quite clear all the scheduling stuff for that, but I think there's GP Brussels coming up, and potentially Prague as well, all before sort of the close of the season. So if I can get my schedule sort of cleared up a wee bit from some of this PhD work, and yeah, we might put some of this PT prize money to use and get some flights. And
yeah, nice, man. Wow, good luck with that. That's so cool. We love watching past guests go on and do great things. So definitely wish you the best of luck as you go and, you know, go forth and do good things. That's really cool. That's really cool. So what would you say, Danny, is your best format or your favorite format?
I would probably say that I've done best in standard formats, specifically any standard format since Kaladesh came out. I have played a reasonable amount of modern, but there are definitely stronger modern players than I would be. But for some reason, my standard results always seem to be slightly better than some of my sort of my friends and my testing partners. So
cool.
I don't know if that's solely because of the presence of, you know, Scrap Heap Scrounger and Unlicensed Disintegration, but
they help.
Definitely help.
So I love talking about standard. Let's dive into that then. So let's just go into, you know, tournament preparation, you know, specifically around choosing your deck. So what does it look like for you? You know, standard is, you know, a beast in and of itself. So how do you decide what to play? When do you decide? Like, just really break that down and break that process down for us.
So generally, I would want to have at least a week before. I'd like to have a decision made a week before I'm going to play a large event. If it's, okay, you know, something like a GP or for the PT, I was kind of mind made up a week before, and then it gives you the opportunity to hone in your practice time and your development time. A lot of people will end up kind of flip-flopping between two in the run-up to an event, and I think that it's quite difficult to switch between, especially if the archetypes are quite different. So, for example, in the standard format, if you were trying to decide between playing blue-white control or red-black, one of these things is playing, you know, one-drop, two-drop, three-drop creatures, and the other one is playing five-drop planeswalkers. You need to pick a plan. So I have no problem with trying a diverse range of things leading up to, you know, the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to it. But the week before the tournament, I'd want to have, if not most of my selection, but at the very least, like, an archetype decided. I want to know how soon I'm going to be registering, like Hazard of the Fervent or Disallowed, you know, something like that. So
yeah. So then leading up to that, you know, 1 week deadline, what are you looking for in the format? How do you whittle down that selection to the one deck that you're going to practice?
I think it's, when you are playing a wide range, I think it's important to keep track of the numbers that you are putting in, but also try and have an idea and an intention for when you're playing games. A lot of people will play a bunch of games and sort of call it testing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have numbers associated with it. I want to know how many games I won on the draw, how many games I won on the play. If there's anything important that happened in these games that, you know, oh, I won all of these games because I played a Land War Elves on turn one. I lost all of these games when they played a Chain Whirler on turn three or something like that. But somewhat counterintuitively, I don't necessarily always go by the numbers. If I have a matchup that I've played maybe 15 times and it looks like something wins 70% of the time, but I felt all of the losses were really close, and, you know, if the matchup feels really close, there's a chance that it's not being represented exactly in,
right,
in the numbers. And sometimes that comes when you're testing with less experienced players, or maybe people that aren't as familiar with those types of archetypes. So
that's a good point. So you kind of survey the field, you're playing different, you know, decks, making your selection a week before. You decide on at least the archetype, if not the deck. And then what are you doing the week of the event?
So at that point, we are playing one side of a matchup continually. We're just looking for any areas where we think we can almost hammer a notch in. So, for example, in the current standard format, I really liked having access to Duress against blue-white control. So it became, what's the best way to... When are we casting Duress? Are we using it just for the turn before? How are we playing the matchup, rather than just, is the matchup good? Is there any little things we can do to tweak the most popular ones that we're expecting? So at that point, you will probably end up with sort of three or four decks that you're targeting.
Okay.
And it becomes less about playing against Bruise or fringe archetypes and more about hitting your important matchups. So,
and practically, like, are you doing a lot of this on Magic Online, or you getting together with your friends? Like, how do you handle that aspect, Danny?
Personally, if I'm looking to test, I will have a couple of people that I message, and then I'll go to their house, my house, cool. Our local game store, and we will sit for a couple of hours. If I'm just wanting to, you know, play games and just sort of put in reps rather than finding out specific information, I'll sit and I'll play two leagues on Magic Online in the evening when I get in. But like I said, I just kind of want to highlight the difference between sitting and playing, you know, 20 leagues of like Magic Online and saying, yeah, testing, or sitting with somebody that you can talk to about decisions and, you know, recording results and looking for specific patterns. I'd say that's closer to testing than just jamming games. So
interesting. Yeah. And both are valuable, you know, both have their place. I think the discussion side has a lot of merit to it and often gets overlooked. And I think that's where you can reap the most benefits, I feel. But it is also important just to, you know, play games and get used to lines of play and things like that. But that discussion is definitely key. So,
yeah, especially if you're trying to learn an archetype that you're maybe not familiar with. But playing games helps you identify sort of very common patterns. And that's actually, playing games helps you with your mulligan decisions. Yeah. This the thing that we were talking about before. You get to identify which two land hands we can keep, which four land hands we can keep. But if we're looking for sort of matchup specific information, grab a buddy and, you know, sit for a couple hours.
Yeah, good stuff. And what do you see working in standard right now? Obviously, release versus recording, there's a couple week delay, but still, I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, standard, where it's at, what's working, decks you like. Just tell us a little bit about the current state of standard.
The sort of pre-M19 standards? Or?
Yeah, kind of like where we're at right now as of you and me talking.
Oh, sure. So I would still be leaning on my sort of red-based aggro decks. I think that a lot of people asked me questions sort of in the lead-up to the RPTQ about effectively what their third deck would be. For, you know, a lot of people sort of carved out red-black, blue-white Esper, and then, you know, what do we put in C3? And I think when you have to ask your questions like that, I think it kind of shows where the metagame is. If you're like having to find a third deck, that means there aren't really, you have like two solid options and then kind of whatever. So I would still be looking at red black. I don't really see anything that's changed to make that not as good, other than sort of general player preference. I think as long as you build with the blue-white deck in mind, so keep your creature only interactive spells to a minimum. So that means things like Chandra and Lightning Strike are slightly more valuable than something like Unlicensed Disintegration or a Braid, because the, you know, creature targeting clause on those will be make them dead cards, where something like Chandra can still interact with, is still a Planeswalker, and Lightning Strike can still occasionally kill a Teferi, whereas something like a Braid is not as strong.
Yeah, very interesting. Very fascinating. And along the lines of observations and learning, stuff like that, as you have played Magic all over, you know, the world, lots of different people, what have you found to be the biggest mistake that players make?
Biggest mistake? That's a really good question. Let me have a think about that. I'll maybe get back to you on that one.
All right.
I'll try and not try not to say anything too harsh.
Well, no, I mean, we need, you know, it's good. Like we need, this is great because we love hearing from people, you know, our guests all over the world and what their perspective on magic is. And just, so when we hear those things, like the mistakes that people make, then it kind of gives us a time to go, oh, and reflect and say, hey, you know, am I making that mistake? And, you know, what can I do about it? So we'll let you mull that in your subconscious for a little bit, as we'll circle back to it for sure. So since you know, are obviously good at standard and keeping up with things, where do you go to keep your finger on the pulse of magic? Do you have resources that you turn to, that you can refer to us?
So in terms of an online resource, I keep track of all of the articles that are put out on sort of any of the major magic sites. You follow, have Twitter, follow all of the content producers, keep an eye on that. But I'd say that one of the biggest things that I've had has actually just been my new LGS, West End Games. There is a group, almost the team there, and they were always up for just bouncing ideas around. And so I think if you're looking for resources like that, I would say a local-based sort of community is probably been the most valuable thing that I've had.
That's so cool. So connecting with a local group that you can bounce ideas off of, that you can play with regularly, that you can talk to, and that you know can meet, that's really good.
Yeah, that's particularly helpful at the start of a format, particularly at the start of a limited format. So we haven't really spoke about limited, but that's definitely not my forte. I'm definitely not as strong there, but there are some players there that are definitely very, you know, very strong there, much more in tune with, you know, we'll look at a set review or a set spoiler and go, okay, so, you know, this card's going to be very good. Oh, why? Because there's, you know, there's more 2/3s, there's more 3/2s than this, and mm-hmm. Oh, this card's good, this card's good. So getting to sort of share ideas with them helps you think about it in that manner as well. So
yeah, so helpful. And if there are three, I guess, attributes that we've seen really impact, you know, magic, we being here on the podcast that we like to focus on, their dedication, sportsmanship, and respect. So how have you seen, you know, dedication, sportsmanship, and respect, you know, impact or play out in your magic experience?
I think dedication is not, I don't want to say an obvious one, but you can definitely identify players that are practicing and players that are looking to improve and are, you know, hungry for success, I would say. So that's definitely important. In terms of sort of sportsmanship and respect, like I was saying, in terms of having access to a local playgroup, a local resource of, you know, friends and test partners, when you move to a new community or you want to get established within a community, it's nice to be nice. You're not going to get, you very rarely get anywhere by not being friendly and, you know, be respectful, be sportsmanlike. There's not a lot of players that do well on a global scale that are disliked by the community at large. And generally, like, you know, the cream's going to rise to the top. You're mm-hmm. going to find that the good players are generally the people that are, you know, respectful, friendly, courteous. So there's definitely a strong correlation there between being an approachable, sociable, friendly person, respectful person, and getting the most out of magic.
Cool. And what have you learned from magic that you've been able to apply to other areas of your life?
Well, that's another really good question. Other than sort of quite a broad sort of general life experience, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've sort of traveled nearly all over the world getting to do this. I think it's helped me learn how to explain something and sort of how to justify my decisions and almost how to, I don't want to say teach because I think that's a strong word, but if you're playing a game or you're replaying a draft or you're doing something else and somebody asks, why did you do this? You know, how do you explain your thought processes? And, you know, oh, I did this because of this. And at the same time, I was thinking about doing this. And that's not, you know, that's not exclusive to Magic. You make decisions all the time about and everything. If it's at work, at school, you know, think about why you're making that decision. So,
yeah, that's good. That's really good. And then circling back around, as you've played Magic, what's been the biggest mistake that you've observed players make?
So I think one of the things that, rather than like a gameplay mistake, I think people are occasionally still too results oriented. And I think that's something that sort of we as a playgroup still find ourselves doing a little bit. It's quite difficult to not be results orientated in a game like Magic. But it's important to remember that, you know, we're not playing chess. There is still variance involved. So sometimes you will play an entire tournament, you will win all your games and you will feel like a champion, but you will have made mistakes still. And it's important to analyze your wins as much as your losses. Particularly, I found the drafts that I learned the most from were the drafts that I thought I had drafted perfectly. Because when you go back and you do those reviews, you think, oh, you know, that pick was wrong, that play was wrong, that mulligan's wrong, but it works out. It's very difficult to analyze mistakes in games that you win.
And you know, I think that's kind of going back to having a group. It's important because one, when you're in playtest mode is different because like when you're playing, then win or lose, you can have a good discussion with somebody. But when you're analyzing your results from an event, especially if you're trying to analyze the wins, it's not always the best to like sit down and talk with your opponent that you just beat. Hey, so when exactly did I start winning? You know, I'm like, because they probably don't want to have that discussion with you. But if you have a support group, you have someone that that you can turn to. You know, this was online. You record it. You can review afterwards, or at least talk to somebody about your live event. You know, afterwards, then you can have that discussion, which we've talked about is key. Like, I'm thinking again back to some of my most recent events where, when I lost, I think, okay, like, why did I lose? And I'm trying to figure it out. And when I win, I just kind of like moved on and stuff like that. And I failed in this aspect right here, which is thinking, okay, why did I win and what happened and stuff like that? And doing that analyzing, because it's just like, oh, there's a win, move on. And so I think you're right in that it's harder to do, but it's equally as important.
Yeah. And that's something that you can help your friends, your teammates with. If they're playing a game, so it's always like, you know, in a top eight match, you obviously want them to win, but we have a habit of writing down any mistakes at all that we think they've maybe made, so that when you do win, yes, you're excited, you've won your quarter, your semi, your final, but did you think about this block that you made on turn four? You know, that put you dead to this sequence. Maybe if you didn't do this, because everybody will analyze their losing games. And you might forget about your winning games, but somebody could write it down for you. That makes it a lot easier. So.
And that's another really good point. Like we talk about, oh, hey, like, you know, have these discussions and have a support group and stuff like that. And it's easy to come at it from the mindset of, oh, like, you know, I'm leaning on them and I want their help to help me and stuff like that. But if you pick up the slack and step up to the plate and are that for somebody else, then it's so much easier to foster that within your community. So if you're the one that, like you just said, that are writing down, you know, questions and feedback and observances of your friends when they play, then, you know, people will be more likely to do that for you. And then that way your whole group will get better because you're nurturing this culture of, you know, positive feedback, win or lose. So I think that's a great idea to take initiative, be the one to step up and start, you know, making note and asking questions about your friend's game so that, you know, everybody is in the habit of doing that and they'll help you out. So that's cool. I like that.
Yeah. In a polite way.
Yeah, of course.
To sort of, to justify that with an anecdote at the Pro Tour Dominaria. One of my friends who had qualified, he unfortunately didn't make day two, so he was sort of quite heavily invested in watching my games. I think this was like the round that I had. It was, you know, effectively a PTQ final. Winning this one would get me guaranteed entry to the next Pro Tour. So I played my game, I won, everybody was really happy. And then he says, did you not deliberately do this line? And I was like, I don't know, I was just kind of thinking about this. And he's like, oh, because if you did it this way, you probably could have like killed him a turn earlier. It's like, oh, so effectively kind of, you know, miss lethal. Yeah, a slightly obscure one. It involves like pumping Pia pre-combat with like the Chandra tick up and stuff. But it's like, did you think about doing that? No, I didn't. Right. Well, remember that that's an option because you've still got another round to play kind of thing.
So yeah.
It happens all the time.
Yeah. Oh, good stuff, man. Good stuff. Well, cool. This has been an awesome chat. I love this. And I wanted to remind the Prodigies, hey, if you want to connect with Danny, you can find him on Twitter at Danderson92. Look him up there. And Danny, as we kind of turn the corner and close things out, I'd love to get one last final tip or trick, advice, some guidance from you that either something you already said that you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end.
I think it's important to remember that, you know, this is still a game. So remember to keep enjoying playing Magic. It can definitely be frustrating. It can sometimes feel like an obligation, but remember that, you know, it's still supposed to be fun, and we do all love this game. That's why we keep coming back every week. So.
Love it. Thank you so much. And Danny, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to Multiverse. And thank you so much for your time, for sharing your experiences with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers. It's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
That's it. Thank you so much for having me.
There you have it. Danny, thank you again for coming on to the show. Episode 293 is all wrapped up. Prodigies, you get the show notes at mtgpro2.com/Danny Anderson. And I want to give a huge shout out, a huge welcome to our newest patron, Nikki. Nikki, thank you so much for your support of the show. It really means a lot to me. I look forward to including you in the drawings moving forward. And of course, I look forward to playing with you in our leagues. Nikki is one of our sealed league regulars, and she always does really well. So if you're interested in playing alongside Nikki and me and others in our upcoming Sealed League, then stay tuned. We will be doing a Core 2019 Prodigy Sealed League. We usually start those a few weeks after the set has been released so that the prices can settle, you know, a little bit before we go out and buy them on Magic Online. So anyways, stay tuned for that. That's coming up. Nikki, welcome. Thank you so much for your support. And of course, Prodigies, if you have found value in these episodes and you want to support the show directly, you can go to mtgprotutor.com/Patreon, and you can learn what that's all about and join Nikki and the other patrons in making MTG Pro Tutor last. Well, that's it for today. Thank you so much again for tuning in. Can't wait until next time. Until then, I'm Sean of the Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.